Are Americans getting more comfortable with normalized political violence? From SDPB, today is Wednesday, June 18th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the Dakota Political Junkies discuss the quality of U.S. democracy in the wake of an alleged politically motivated assassination. David Wiltsie and Lisa Hager join us. Mike Thompson is with us. We'll have an update on recent opinions from the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll look at the impact of cases even as we await highly anticipated decisions in the days ahead. That conversation is coming a bit later in the hour. But first, Kevin Wooster returns to the program. We will talk about the South Dakota state budget in historical context as gubernatorial candidates seek to convince voters of their budget bona fides. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment, and news is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A week ago, you heard Speaker of the House John Hansen on SDPB. He joined us to discuss his political background and his stance on the issues now that he is a 2026 candidate for governor. One of the issues he lifted up was his dedication to balancing South Dakota's budget without a deficit, and how he would institute a DOGE here in the state if he were governor. Kevin Wooster is a veteran journalist in South Dakota. He joined me in SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City with some historical context and analysis. Kevin Wooster, welcome back to the SDPB studios. It's good to have you in the room, even though we're across the state.
It's really good to be back. Last time I talked to you, I still had my prostate. I don't have that anymore, but I guess we don't need to go into any great detail about that.
I do feel like the state of South Dakota wants to know that you're doing well.
Yeah, just a reminder to all guys 40 and over, or especially if you have family history, to watch your PSA, check with your doc, stay on top of things. So
yeah. And you're still engaging in that political process because we had an interview on the show with John Hansen, who is now running for governor, and you sent a text and said, not so fast on 2011 deficit policymaking. There's more to that story. And I said, come and talk to me about it. So I went back and listened. And basically, in John Hansen's interview, he talks about his first year in office in the state legislature and coming in with a $127 million deficit and changing the way state government worked by making some tough cuts. And he said, that's what we did. And there's another person in that we that you wanted to talk about. Tell me who was governor then.
Take us
back to that time frame in state government, because you covered it. I didn't. I wasn't here yet.
We can't forget Dennis Dugard, because he was the driver behind that. And he got support from Hansen in his first year and some other new legislators, Republican legislators and others. I mean, he got a lot of support when Dugard was campaigning in the 2010 election. He was making it clear that we had to do something, he believed, about an ongoing budget deficit. And I know that you brought that up to Hansen and said, wait a minute, we can't have budget deficits.
Right, yeah.
And they called it a structural deficit because it was in the structure of the budget that we weren't taking in as much as we were spending, but we were able to find other one-time money to fill that gap each year for a number of years. And as we always hate to talk about it, but it was federal stimulus money for a few years that was coming out of Obama. Previously, it had come out of the Bush administration that helped us continue to make the kinds of increases we wanted to make, maybe not as big as they were, but some increases in education, spending, aid to schools and Medicaid providers and state employees and things like that. And so Governor Rounds had managed to, and the legislature had balanced the budget with those extra monies.
Right.
Dugard decided, and I have to give Rounds credit, in two things. He can be criticized for doing that, for allowing that structural deficit to be there, but he also didn't want to cut. I mean, nobody wants to cut, especially education, which is a struggle the way it is.
Right.
So he used those one-time monies. And in his last budget message in the fall of 2010, he suggested that he and his budget would have 5% cuts, his proposed budget. Obviously, he wasn't going to be there for it. and some one-time money spending to fill in. So they were looking at cuts already. Dugard just said, we're going to take care of this budget deficit, which was about $127 million at the time, and came in when he became governor and said 10% cuts across the board, including, and I think he took greater cuts himself. I think he took like a 15% cut in his salary or something, and his office took a 12% or something. And he said, we're just going to do that, which Janklow had done years earlier, you know, across the board, go cut these things. And so he took that to the legislature. And obviously, can you imagine in a state where education struggles the way it is, say 10% cut?
Right.
Lot of heat. And eventually they worked out a deal sort of with some one-time money and things where education itself only took a 6% cut, I think, in state aid, state funding. But, and some other unified judicial system found some one-time money or something. But basically everybody took a 10% cut overall. And he got, with the help of the legislature, including the first-timer like Hansen.
Mm-hmm.
But I had some notes, and I said, there were the Appropriations Committee folks did the real heavy lifting, and that was Larry Tiedemann and Lance Carson and Dean Wink, who's, you know, mm-hmm. still around, and Corey Brown. But they got that done, took some heat at home, and got rid of that structural deficit. And it's been a kind of a standard for South Dakota budgeting since then, that we won't allow deficits spending, even if we have money to fill in the gap. And I should say, Dugard said at the time, things will turn around, we hope, we believe, you know, coming off that 2008 recession. And when they do, we will make up what we cost you as much as we can. And as you know, in education, that meant in 2016, was it, that came up with a half-cent sales tax increase, half-percent sales tax increase for education and person property tax relief. So
yeah.
he kept his word.
Yeah. So I started here in 2015. I lived in South Dakota before that, but I started in this job in 2015. And I just remember every time I went to Governor Dennis Dugard budget hearing or State of the State address, I would like go home when I was done and like balance my checkbook because he had given like this financial lesson.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, oh, I can do better at home. Like, listen to this. But that's why in context then, because I didn't know what had come before because I wasn't paying as close attention. Again and again, he was dealing with that one-time money goes to one-time expenses, and that's it. One-time money goes to one-time expenses. And we're still doing that, aren't we?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't comb through the budget. Yeah, so.
Try to. And, you know, that had been a general philosophy even before then.
Mm-hmm.
But I think with Dugard ratcheting it down to, it's not just a philosophy. I mean, we're going to do it, absolutely.
It was a discipline, yeah.
Yeah, and he was very fiscally conservative. And yet, here he was a guy that, you know, and sliding into another subject, came on a few years later and pushed a tax increase for mm-hmm. education.
Yeah.
So you couldn't put him in a box philosophically always.
Right. And he would say often about the exemptions that if you tried to attack any of those exemptions, that people would accuse you of raising taxes. So he was very politically astute.
Oh, yeah.
Of, you know, of course, all governors are probably politically astute. But he would say that in an interview. We're like, yeah, I would like to get rid of some of these exemptions because I think there are too many of them. But every time you do, you're the guy that raised a tax, even though he didn't necessarily see it as raising a tax per se. But that's how it would be positioned in the public and in the political argument.
Yeah, yeah. If you allow a tax to sunset as it was supposed to do in the law, and the tax go back to where it was, did you raise a tax, or did you just let it go back to where it was?
Right. So he makes what you said, this is a recession, and he says, we hope in the future times will get better. Now, what I'm hearing from John Hansen is, you know, free market, lower taxation, lower regulation, get rid of some of this, you know, Governor's Office of Economic Development work, because now government has increased, and I think he used the word bloated in his interview with me. It's like gone back to what it was. Is there truth in that? Has the state government grown back to something bigger and therefore ripe for more cuts?
Well, it's an animal that's going to grow. I mean, that's for sure. And is it bloated? I don't know. You know, I'm not covering it on a day-to-day basis anymore. I'm not out there anymore. If you're running for governor, that's exactly what you're going to say, whether it's true or not. And I suppose if you want to, makes me think of a, is it a book title of Christine Ohm's, of Not Going Back There?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, No Going Back.
Yeah, if you don't believe that any of those governors from Janklow to Mikkelsen to Dugard knew what they were doing, I suppose you can reconfigure the whole thing and say, you know, the system has been messed up forever. But I tend to think most of them knew what they were doing most of the time pretty well, and maybe there's some ways to tweak what they did a little bit, but I certainly don't think you need to reconfigure the whole thing. Our system has worked pretty well for quite a while.
And here we are with education and teacher pay being, you know, dropping back down to the lower registers. And we have, you mentioned, federal money. We have big question marks and some, you know, things that are already taking place in the state where the federal money is going to be less. What kind of challenges do you think that will give lawmakers and gubernatorial candidates right now? Because it would not be popular to criticize the presidential administration, and yet some of the impacts of those decisions are not going to be great for South Dakotans, depending on how you look at it. I mean, of course, other people would say, yeah, it's great for South Dakotans in the long term because the government, federal government's not spending too much money, but you might lose services in the state. What's the impact of that going to be on these candidates as they try to parse that out with voters?
Yeah, if you're Republican, you're parsing it out. That means, Trump's doing a good job. I have to support him on this.
Yeah.
The congressional delegation's in a different spot a little bit, in that they're in a position where they can go in and talk to him or talk to his people and say, listen, can you give us a little relief on these areas? We're really getting hurt here. The people running for governor in particular, but most Republicans, office holders in South Dakota right now, are going to have to live with whatever comes down from Washington as long as Donald Trump's there.
Mm-hmm.
And smile when they do it, I guess. But it's going to make a difference. And you can say that all of this, it's high time, and maybe it is to a certain extent, but again, how much do you cut and how much do you remove from a system that has been functioning, I think, quite well for a long time? And who gets hurt? And how much do you care about the ones that are getting hurt?
Mm. It is difficult to run for office and distinguish yourself and say, this is working great, I want to keep it going, especially if you're trying to. And Seth Tupper, I think, helped me think about this better because I said, I don't understand. I mean, Larry Roden's an incumbent, it would be difficult to beat. Why would so many people? And he said, well, it's like an open seat, essentially, because of the way that, you know, he came from lieutenant governor position. And that makes a little more sense to me. Do you see, with the number of candidates that we sort of anticipate coming forward and announcing, is this kind of an atypical year? Or do you have reference points that you can look back on and say, yeah, this is how South Dakota works in a Republican primary particularly?
Well, I think if you know, the one thing you look back on is when Walter Dale Miller succeeded George Mikkelsen because mm-hmm. of the tragic plane crash
mm-hmm.
and had a couple of years as governor, and he was a well-experienced guy, you know, West River Ranch, cowboy hat wearing guy, and had been in leadership positions in the legislature for many years, and he ran. And now, Bill Janklow was a different deal, a politician to deal with altogether, but he ran, and we said, no, thanks, Walter Dale, for being a bridge, but we're going to go back to what we know, and that's Janklow. Mm. I think this is a little bit different, first of all, because that one came out of a tragedy, and mm-hmm. I think that left the whole state in a different mindset, and this Roden has kind of, I don't want to, and everybody loved Mikkelsen, or most people loved Mikkelsen, so there was this terrible loss. I think there was some, when Roden came to replace Noam, or to, you know, to succeed Noam, I think there was a sense of relief, even among Noam supporters,
yeah,
that all of the drama is over, and the out-of-state trips, and the
guessing, you know, what will she do and when.
Fighting with the tribes, fighting with legislators, fighting with the media. And we like somebody to steady the ship. And Roden, I think, has done a really good job of that.
Yeah.
And now somebody that I would have kind of thought he's going to go the way of Walter Dale Miller is using that position. I've you know, I'm a steady hand at the tiller, and now he's going around doing what governors do, doing governor's work, but also campaigning like crazy in areas where he needs to campaign. And I guess where I would have written him off before and thought there's no way he could beat Dusty Johnson, probably couldn't beat Marty Jackley, Toby Doden, I don't know. I would say, I don't know, I guess I'm looking at that a little different now, although I still look at him and I see him in a TV interview with the cowboy hat on and kind of the uncomfortable looking sports coat with the open collar shirt, thinking, I wish I was wearing a chamois shirt right now and doing some welding, and thinking, is he the guy that people in Sioux Falls and Vermilion and Brookings and are going to elect to be governor? I don't know.
Yeah. And he hasn't said whether he's running, has he? He hasn't made an announcement. He's just said, you cannot assume that I'm not. Because he was asked that, like, at a press conference. Can we assume that you're not, you know, going? And he said, no, you cannot assume that. So that's the last time I heard of an update on that.
Yeah, I would assume he's running. I'd be kind of shocked if he's not running.
He certainly looks
like a candidate. I would say this about him. I think he looks more gubernatorial all the time. I still think a Western rancher, welder, are we ready for that?
Well, Tony Von Heisen is his lieutenant governor. So if you want to send someone to Sioux Falls, you just send Lieutenant Governor Von Heisen. Yeah.
That was smart for campaign purposes. And I don't know, does that mean, has anybody ever answered the question, has that taken former Governor Dugard's sort of pledge to support Dusty if he ran for governor? Has that taken that off the table?
Yeah.
I assume it has.
These are big questions about endorsements, so as well, and that will play into the future. When do you anticipate we'll start seeing some of the other announcements other than John Hansen and Toby Doden?
Well, let's see, when is it? Oh, it's next year.
And we're about a year out,
It's going to have to be fairly soon, and boy, how much money do you think Doden's going to spend, including his own money?
Right.
And if I'm Dusty Johnson, I'm seeing all these ads, and I'm going, wow, I don't think I need to put ads up yet, but he's really getting out there. I have to say that. Doden's ads are pretty good.
Yeah, I have not seen any of them yet. We have had John Hansen on, and then Toby Doden will be our next invite, so we just haven't done that yet.
You have everybody on? I forget, that's the other thing, you know, when you were called far too left-wing of South Dakota Public Media to come on by the former governor, and all the while Rounds and Dugard and Johnson and Jackley and everybody, and now Doden's on and Hansen was on, and they all seem to come on, and they don't turn into left-wing liberals.
Here's one thing I will say that I noticed about John Hansen during his interview with me, is he looks to me like he's going to have a lot of fun on the campaign trail.
I listened to that interview, which I thought was a great interview, and some of the impressions I've had about Hansen, which have not been entirely positive over the years, I enjoyed that interview, and I got that sense of enthusiasm, and he came off as, you know, really intelligent and with a good sense of humor. And
he came off as relaxed and happy.
Relaxed,
Knows who he is, and he's ready to go try to get people to know who he is, which I would also argue most of the state is meeting him for the first time.
Yeah, he definitely sounded like a viable candidate during your interview.
Wow. Well, we do great interviews here. We bring out the best.
You did. You do. Absolutely. It's important.
That's Kevin Wooster, a longtime South Dakota journalist. He has reported for the Brookings Register, the Sioux Falls Argus Leader, the Rapid City Journal, Kello TV, SDPB, and South Dakota Searchlight, to name just a few. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Our Dakota political junkies join us now with a roundup of political news from this weekend. We will discuss protests, a parade, and political violence that happened in our neighboring state to the east. Lisa Hager is an associate professor of political science at South Dakota State University. She joined us from SDPB's Janine Basinger studio at SDSU in Brookings. David Wiltsey is a professor of political science at SDSU. He joined the conversation via Zoom.
Initially, you know, I was, you know, shocked, like, you know, most people were. I mean, this fortunately is a fairly rare event when it comes to actual elected officials being targeted. by this kind of violence. But then the, you know, the political scientist in me and the person who studied political history kind of took a step back and realized that this isn't as aberrant as we might hope. And that, you know, in the United States, we do have a pretty steady past of politically motivated violence. Luckily, it's something that is fairly infrequent. You know, other types of violence are far more likely to occur, but it is there. And I also began to think about the public opinion research that we've done on this. And there is a pretty good chunk of Americans who don't rule out the use of violence when it comes to their political ends. We've been tracking this as political scientists for a number of years. And since 2015, 2016 or so, we've seen a steady rise of the number of people who will say in a public opinion survey that, yes, violence is at times justified for a political end. And at the moment, that's about 20% of the American people.
Wow.
So this is something that, even though it is a minority view, that's a substantial amount of folks. And when we push people a little bit beyond that, up to 60% of people agree that violence is justified if the other side starts it. So we are in many ways kind of primed for this kind of an outburst to take place from time to time.
Yeah.
And that's just a sad fact of how politics has unfolded here in the United States, particularly in the last 10 years.
Yeah. And everyone's watching for what is the information about this person's political motivations? How are people from both parties going to respond to it? What is the right thing to say? Who didn't say the right thing? Who made a phone call and who didn't make a phone call? What used to be a cry for unification, you know, oh, we're all Americans and someone's been attacked. That's what you hope would happen, is that everybody would pull together after a terrible event. In these cases, people seem to pull further apart.
Yeah, we're seeing it increasingly in a partisan lens, and increasingly from a perspective of a very polarized electorate, and an electorate that is much more hostile towards its political opposition than we were 20, 30 years ago.
Mm.
So how we assimilate this information and the conclusions we draw are so often going to be tinged by the very things that are creating this this environment in the first place.
Yeah.
So we kind of get into this terrible spiral of reinforcement.
Lisa, as you watched the story unfold, what were some things that were standing out to you?
So for me, it just went back to the fact that there were discussions about, does this chill the type of speech that we're seeing from elected officials because they won't want to incite this type of violence unto themselves? Similarly, is this something that just chills people's willingness to pursue public service, knowing that they can become targets? I think there's maybe some thought processes amongst Americans that this is something that tends to happen to our federal governmental officials, but not someone who's serving at these lower levels of government at this, you know, state or local levels. And so that's one thing that I think has been interesting watching this unfold.
Yeah. Where do we go from here? What's next? Is it just that we move on? Because on the weekend that this was happening, we also had No Kings protests across the country, which were largely peaceful. But then when I was looking at some of the incidents that happened, I was like, well, there was a time when that incident would have been a really big deal. And it is sort of down in two-thirds of the way through the article where it's like, yeah, and someone drove a car through this protest, and, you know, that's noteworthy as well. And we had the U.S. Army's 250th birthday parade on President Trump's actual birthday as well. So we had this show of military celebration in D.C. Meanwhile, switch the channel and you have No Kings protests. Switch the channel, you have a manhunt in Minnesota. That's kind of a whiplash.
I think that's just American political news as of late, to be completely honest. It just seems like something happens and then very quickly we have to pivot to something else. think about the attempted assassination on Trump. We right. talked about that, and then I can't even remember what the next story was, but that didn't stay in the news cycle as the dominant story for very long.
So where do we go from here? Are there ways that when you two are sitting down with students and your students are saying, well, is this just, you know, business as usual in America? What are some of the things that you try to encourage them to be thinking about? Dave, we'll start with you there.
Well, honestly, this is not something that I talk too much about my students on a regular basis. And I think this kind of speaks to what we're saying about a chilling effect.
Yeah.
In some ways, this, you know, it does affect the way that I handle my job, the way that I handle my students, and how I avoid some of these things, just because I don't want to get caught up in this in any real way. I mean, I have had some threats from time to time because of what I do, and that chilling effect is very real. And just as, you know, you were saying with the chilling effect on office holders, there's going to be a chilling effect on participants as well. And that just has profound effects on the quality of our democracy. And it is kind of the objective of a lot of these people who are perpetrating this kind of violence. They want to change the rules of the game. They want to shift the policymaking process from an extended conversation and debate amongst elected office holders to a situation where the person who is able to predominate with the use of force or by chilling conversations and interactions, so these can be implemented in a different way. In a lot of ways, they're trying to change the rules of the game of our political system.
Yeah,
and that's where I get really fearful about the direction we're taking. And quite honestly, I don't have an answer to where we go from here.
Yeah. Lisa, the quality of our democracy. Are there ways that you think about that, measure it, fear for it?
Yeah. So I was thinking even about your question relating to discussing this with students. And I would say for the most part, the nature of the topics that I teach from a more institutional perspective don't tend to get too much into this particular topic, but of course, kind of thinking about things in terms of your more recent question relating to democracy and how do we measure it, I think naturally we think of highly democratic societies as ones that do not have these issues where there's political violence taking place. We typically associate that with countries that are less developed, countries that I think most Americans would say we are not like. And so then we need to start coming to terms with the fact that there are things that are happening in terms of political violence, in terms about confidence in elections, and a variety of other things that are happening here that do cause the United States to not always rank very high in terms of respecting democratic values. And then I think it comes down to, as students, as really the next generation, what can you do about that? And to get back to what Dave said, it may be chilling them to want to do much or say much if there's this fear that if I get involved or if I say something that someone doesn't like, especially if I am someone who's prominently involved in politics, that might have some very severe consequences that are potentially fatal. So I think there needs to be a way to address these kinds of issues in a more positive, probably isn't the best way, but in a healthy way where they can be addressed without fear of retribution.
I would also say, you know, this person was, you know, hundreds of police officers worked in collaboration, neighbors called in tips, and the man was brought into custody in a fairly short period of time, and justice will be served. So that does still distinguish us from, you know, a country where it's just a hit and everybody moves on and there's nothing. We're not helpless, I guess. I don't feel helpless after
no,
this.
No, yeah. No, for sure. It's just coming to terms with that, where I think a lot of young people think of and even just Americans in general, we think of ourselves as the gold standard when it comes to democracy, but we've had these stains on our reputation.
Yeah, sure.
And we do need to come to terms with that.
When it comes to what sustains democracies around the world, is norms. it's not so much the institutions, it's not so much their constitutions, the way that they construct their legislatures or their executives, but it's these norms that really guide and shape our behavior. And what's happening is we have a breakdown in a lot of these norms that for democracy, one of the most important norms is that this is the only game in town, that there isn't other legitimate ways to shape public policy outside of nonviolent democratic means. And where the political elite bear some responsibility here and where they might be able to have some good effect is by really trying to reinforce these norms in their day-to-day, you know, being very careful about what they say, how they characterize their political adversaries. If you get used to a dehumanizing and a demonizing characterization of your political adversaries, you're going to become more willing to use violence. You're going to be more willing to use some of these non-democratic means to shape policy. And, you know, this is where the parties really need to step up. This is where individuals in government really need to step up. And unfortunately, so many of them, so many of the people in our institutions are incented to be as inflammatory as they possibly can. And this is a consequence of it.
Our Dakota political junkies today, Lisa Hager and David Wiltsy. Hager is an associate professor and Wiltsy is a professor both of political science and both at South Dakota State University. You can find this conversation and more on your podcast feeds. Search for SDPB's Dakota Political Junkies for weekly news analysis. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The U.S. Supreme Court has been busy. We're checking in again with University of Sioux Falls professor Mike Thompson. Thompson is an associate professor of criminal justice. He joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studios in Sioux Falls. Let's begin here with a unanimous ruling in a reverse discrimination case. There's an Ohio woman who said she was discriminated against because she was heterosexual. And now we have some clarity on that. And this one is unanimous.
Unanimous opinion.
What did the court say?
Unanimous opinion.
Well, first, what are some of the facts of the case?
She, a heterosexual woman. I think it's important to note that this case is under Title VII, which is a congressional statute that regulates discrimination based on race, sex, gender, in employment. More categories than that, but those are relevant to this one. It's not an equal protection claim because sometimes Title VII, which is the congressional statute, and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th, they connect or they okay. sometimes are in conflict. The main difference is Title VII as a congressional statute will regulate non-governmental activity. So Title VII applies to all employers in interstate commerce who have 15 or more employees. The 14th, the Equal Protection Clause, relates only to governmental action. So that's a distinction I think that needs to be made.
So if you work for a business that only has 5 employees and you get fired and you think you were discriminated against, you have no recourse?
Oh, that's not true.
All right.
Because every state has its own anti-discrimination
laws. Okay. All right. Yep. You would just have to use the right argument
to
get at them.
Go under state law then, yeah.
All right. And this court decides unanimously, not in her favor because they don't decide on the result of the case, but what do they decide unanimously in favor of?
What she has to prove. So
okay.
under Title VII, there's a claim you can make called a disparate treatment claim, which means if I am intentionally discriminated against based on one of the categories in Title VII by my employer, I can sue the employer for a Title VII violation. So in this case, I think it was the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which was the lower court, they said that the first step of proving a disparate treatment claim is you have to show a prima facie on its face case that you were discriminated against. The Sixth Circuit added for a majority member, a member of a majority group, like this woman, a heterosexual white woman, added an extra element called background circumstances. And that would require her to prove something in addition to that she's got a prima facie case of discrimination. It put more of a burden on her because of her majority status, and I'm saying that in air quotes, because of her majority status. Supreme Court said, no, it's even for every race. Mm. That first step, all you have to show, and it's not a real big burden, as the Supreme Court noted, you have to show a prima facie case of discrimination.
Mm. Which would mean I am more qualified, I have more experience. You gave the position to somebody else, it should have been mine.
Yep, absolutely.
I think that feels like discrimination to me. Tell me why it's not,
right,
essentially.
Right.
And that goes for everybody.
Goes for everybody.
And yep, they were sympathetic to that argument.
Right. Even though
in the oral arguments, too, yeah?
Right. And in Title VII, when it was originally passed back in the mid-60s, it was meant, of course, to rectify past discrimination. So I think some of that was in the Sixth Circuit's opinion, like, we need to make this harder because the intent of the law was not to benefit those in the majority group. It was meant to benefit those in the minority group.
I see. Okay.
But the Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to keep it equal across the board. And, yeah, it's unanimous, which always sends a more powerful message than a divided court.
Does this also sort of take the teeth out of discrimination claims that are arguing that DEI has taken over your workplace? You know, when people say, uh-huh, oh, well, it lowers the burden of proof for people in the quote-unquote majority group, but it also says, you know, you're going to have some evidence if you think somebody got promoted over you just because your company has a DEI policy.
Right, right, yep.
Interesting.
It is interesting.
All right.
It's all interesting.
Here's another interesting one. Snope.
Snope.
Snope and Brown.
Yeah, Snope and Brown. This one's weird because it's one where the Supreme Court agreed not to hear it.
Yeah.
Remember, they didn't. To hear it, they issue a writ of certiorari. It only takes 4 justices to issue the writ. And on this one, they didn't. Alito and Gorsuch would have granted certiorari along
with... Let's talk about what this is first.
Along,
yeah.
Okay.
This is a ban on semi-automatic rifles,
right,
in Maryland from 2013.
Uh-huh. It's a ban on AR-15s.
Okay.
AR-15s in Maryland. Kavanaugh and Thomas Wright opinions objecting to the lack of certiorari.
Okay.
Kavanaugh says there are in America right now between 20 and 30 million AR-15s. 41 out of 50 states allow AR-15s, so only 9 states regulate or ban AR-15s. Maryland outright categorically banned AR-15s. So Kavanaugh goes... it's interesting at the end of his opinion, but he goes through his opinion and sets out the 3 major Second Amendment cases, the District of Columbia versus Heller, the Bruin case, and the latest case, Rahimi. And he says that we're back now to looking at whether weapons are in common use, and looking at the text and mm-hmm. what was happening at the time of the founding. So we're back to this sort of originalist approach to what arms can we regulate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird because the court has gone back to at the time of the Constitution's founding, what was going on with guns, and has also vaulted up to 1868 when the 14th was ratified to say, okay, what was going on with guns then? Because that's when the Bill of Rights began to be applied to the states. Although the second wasn't applied to the states until 2008. So he goes through all of that, that history. He's got some, of course, his statistics. He doesn't have a citation for where he's getting these numbers.
This is his argument against denying the writ.
Right. He says,
okay,
we got to hear this
case.
Kavanaugh doesn't necessarily. Kavanaugh just says, here's why we're not.
Okay.
But Thomas and Alito say, we need to hear this case because mm-hmm. this is just flat wrong according to our precedents. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the ban because it said AR-15s were dangerous and unusual weapons. So the Fourth Circuit said that because they're dangerous and unusual, they don't fit within the definition of arms in the Second Amendment.
Okay.
So under Supreme Court precedent now, if I can show that the gun that's being regulated fits within the definition of arms, then the burden passes to the government to show essentially why it shouldn't be regulated. Mm-hmm. So the Fourth Circuit actually said that AR-15s are dangerous and unusual, and they aren't arms.
And best used in sustained military or combat operations. Right. That's the argument. These are military weapons.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are.
So let's go back to this idea, because here's what, I mean, I think obviously there's, again, the tension is from Second Amendment purists who say 30 million people own an AR, and they're not all out doing dangerous, unusual things with them.
Right.
So this is a common weapon now. Times have changed.
Yep, it's a weapon in common usage.
So this doesn't, and then other people are saying, no, we do have a right to regulate ghost guns and machine guns and grenade launchers and these things.
Yeah.
So now if everybody starts buying grenade launchers, does that mean that somehow, well, now it's common.
Absolutely.
And people aren't just launching grenades everywhere. So there's two tensions. You know, one is the Second Amendment does in fact protect us. Yeah. Legal, law-abiding citizens have the right to own and carry all these things.
Yeah, and you can't, I don't, well, my opinion, I don't think the court can get into these ad populum results where they say, okay.
Yeah, that seems weird to me, yeah.
It's a logical fallacy. You just can't base a constitutional protection on how many people are owning
a
firearm.
Buy something, on essentially, how successful a product is.
Right, yeah. And Kavanaugh says, in the next term or two, maybe we'll decide this issue. I think the court's having trouble with that Bruin opinion, where Thomas, who wrote that opinion, took the court back to this nation's founding idea and what was going on. I think the court's finding that to be a difficult standard to apply. And I think Kavanaugh's point is that let's let a few other circuits decide this, and if they're in conflict, then we'll take it and resolve the conflict.
Okay.
But if you've got only 9 states who are regulating ARs, it's doubtful that somebody's going to start a lawsuit over that.
Yeah.
They might now because the court is a little off on
because there's some signaling going on.
Yeah.
The court will signal. This is what we'd rather see this. But no, this is not the right case to address this issue.
Right. Well, Alito and Thomas think it is.
They do, yeah.
Yep. Kavanaugh says,
maybe
chill
a different,
out, fellas.
Yeah, different
chill out, fellas.
And the others say, no.
No, we're not. Yeah, no, we're not. This is, which is,
this
I think,
is clearly
is,
within the,
Yeah. So that was an interesting one where certiorari wasn't granted, I think. So that remains the law there in the Fourth Circuit that you can ban AR-15s.
And they blocked the $10 billion lawsuit by Mexico against gun manufacturers, too, right?
Yeah, they did. They,
so ghost guns, still banned. They upheld the Biden ban.
Yep.
This one they refused to see.
Yep.
And they also said, no, Mexico, you cannot sue gun manufacturers. What happened with that one?
Smith & Wesson versus Mexico, essentially. And that's another unanimous opinion. There's a federal statute called Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, which federal statute that says you can't sue a gun manufacturer for criminal or unlawful use of its product. Two exceptions to that. One is that if the gun manufacturer knows that the gun is going to be used for illegal conduct, and if the plaintiff, Mexico here, can show that the manufacturer and the sale and the marketing of the weapon was the proximate cause of the illegal use.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no evidence that any of the gun manufacturers knew. So
you'd almost have to have evidence like the cigarette, the tobacco companies. You would have to have a meeting between manufacturer officials where they say, now look, we can fuel the gun war in Mexico if we put this ad out here and here's the best way to do it, and that would be abhorrent. But you would have to know that happened. You'd have to prove some pretty intentional messaging.
Right. It would be
and they did not.
Very good. Yeah. No. It would be a very fact-bound determination. You'd have to, you're right, you'd have to have the exact facts that would fit one of those, and fit one of those situations. And the proximate cause thing, there has to be some sort of connection between the gun manufacturer and the person who used the gun illegally.
Yeah, right.
And the court says there's
no. Unanimously, that's not what's happening here.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. So Mexico's out.
What's left? Skrmetti is left.
Yes.
Transgender.
Yes.
Youth.
Yes.
Gender affirming care out of Tennessee, the ban on that, we still don't know at the time that you and I are speaking.
Right.
We do not know how that is going to be.
Yeah. Right. And the docket that we've talked about before, this secret docket, you know, where all these, where Trump's asking for a stay and all those things. Mm-hmm. Those things are still going on. I think it's good.
Not going to be much of a break for the...
No.
The summer is not going to be spent fishing.
No, probably. Well, you never know. Probably not. The Constitution sets the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction, which is its power to hear and decide cases for the first time. Congress sets the court's jurisdiction on appeals and all other situations. So Congress is who allows these types of applications to go directly to the Supreme Court, which is interesting. I got one more, can I?
Yeah.
Snope versus Brown is where the court said we're not going to grant certiorari. The other one is Apache Stronghold. It's a case called Apache Stronghold versus the United States. And I think it's relevant because we have 9 tribes in South Dakota. But in that case, the Apache, well, it's on federal land right now. It's called Oak Flat, and the Apaches use it for a coming-of-age ceremony, and they call Oak Flat their corridor to the Creator. And Resolution Copper wants to mine where Oak Flat is. And
what state is this?
This is in Arizona. This case is not brought under... Apache Stronghold is a nonprofit organization that brought the lawsuit against the United States, saying that this substantially impacts the Apache religion. Mm-hmm. They didn't bring it under the First Amendment. They brought it under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which has been a congressional statute for a long time. And the Apache would have to show that the government's action is a substantial burden on its exercise of religion. And that if they can show that, then the government has to show that this is the least restrictive way of
doing the government this. Mining, or the government has opened it for mining?
Right. It's on
federal. So it's a private company, but it's on federal land.
It's on federal land.
Okay.
But the U.S. government and Resolution Copper agreed to a land swap where Resolution Copper can come in and have the ground on which Oak Flat exists, and the United States gained title to other property that Resolution Copper owned. So now, according to Gorsuch, who wrote a long opinion saying we should hear this case, wasn't in the majority, he said that the mining is going to create this 2-mile-wide, 1,000-foot-deep crater. It's totally going to destroy Oak Flat. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said that I shouldn't laugh, but said that the mining is not going to be a substantial burden on the Apache's exercise of their religion. Therefore, it doesn't violate the Religion Freedom Restoration Act.
Did they deny this one?
Yeah, they denied
this one.
They denied
it. Okay, so Gorsuch did not get his way.
Did not get his way.
So Oak Flats will be...
Oak Flats going to get destroyed.
It will happen.
Yeah.
That is Mike Thompson, Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Sioux Falls. And that's our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. Our executive producer is Kara Hetland. I'm your host, Lori Walsh. From all of us at SDPB, thank you for listening.